KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's 9:06.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. New research from the Federal Food and Drug Administration shows that people who smoke menthol cigarettes start smoking at an earlier age, and they have a harder time kicking the habit. We're going to find out why the FDA may call for new regulations on menthol cigarettes. That's coming up, plus a conversation with singer-songwriter Shelby Earl. The issue of college affordability has been in the headlines this summer. The Senate just approved a measure to keep the interest rate for federal subsidized Stafford loans at 3.9% for undergrads, at least temporarily. But Congress has yet to come up with a plan to make it easier for families to pay for college educations for their kids. That's something Gig Harbor Democrat Larry Sequest hopes to address in the next legislative session. Representative Sequest will introduce a bill to let kids attend college for free and pay their tuition after they graduate and get jobs. Larry Sequest joins us now. Hello.
Hi, Marcy. Good morning.
Can you explain a bit more about how this model would work?
Yes, and Marcy, the credit really goes to John Burbank and the Economic Opportunity Institute in Seattle that have been, they discovered this idea in some other countries, have been working very hard on the actuarial calculations to make sure the numbers work. So the basic idea is this, is that rather than paying tuition to go to college, we, the state, would pay the price of going to college, and you, the student, would sign a contract saying for the next 20 or 25 years, you'd pay a small percentage of your future income to repay us. So that would make it easy to get through college, and it would also means test your repayment. So if you were turned out to be a lawyer making a ton of money, your payment would be higher than if you went into public interest law or were a community worker not making very much money. Either one of you could afford to go to college.
The Oregon legislature recently made national headlines when it approved a measure to study something called tuition-free education. Is this the same thing?
It is. And in fact, there were some Portland State University students who were aware of what we were exploring here in Washington State, and they got their legislature to pass a bill to study the idea. What I'm hoping is that we can build on the work that John and the Economic Opportunity Institute have been doing through the summer and fall and working with our universities and colleges. I'm hopeful we'll have a practical program ready to offer the legislature in January.
How do you imagine something like this would be implemented? All at once in sections?
Marcy, that's precisely the problem we're trying to solve now. There are a large number of ways, depending on how much money you put up front and where you target it. Let me give you a couple of examples. We could, for example, go to a medical school and say, we'll take care of the tuition for doctors and nurses and physician's assistants if you will sign a contract to go work in rural areas. And because they would be able to repay us at the lower income levels the doctors and nurses make out in rural areas, we would probably see a shift of medical students going to rural areas. Or we could target it at very low income students. That's what we're trying to figure out now, is which of those many options would be the two or three that make most sense.
How have our state colleges and universities reacted to this proposal?
Well, they're thinking about it. This is a major change of business. And so we're working with colleges, universities, with the Student Achievement Council. We have a very important organization here in Olympia called the Washington Student Achievement Council that is now looking through. They're the technician experts about how much it costs to go to college. They manage the hundreds of millions of dollars the state spends now on student aid. So we've got the universities, colleges, and staffs starting to think this through for themselves.
A recent article in The Atlantic pointed out that a lot of student debt is is actually non-tuition related. The ancillary costs, books are incredibly expensive, room and board. How would this kind of plan address those costs?
Again, we have to decide just how broad we would open that window. That's part of the actuarial study we need to do this summer to see just what those costs would be, how you could make sure that it made sense to the individual student. And I would say, Marcy, that it's important we look at this as just one of a family of things that we're going to use to attack the cost of going to college. It is too darned expensive to go to college. Those college debts are hurting our economy. The cost of college is preventing people from going to school. So here in the state, I'm determined that we're going to attack this as hard as possible the next year or two.
Representative Larry Sequist is with us. He is a Democrat. He represents the 26th Legislative District. This was the first legislative, very long legislative session in years where the price of tuition for our state's higher education institutions did not go up. And I'm wondering if you could characterize the sentiment in Olympia, both sides of the aisle, when it comes to the cost of college education.
Yeah, and Marcy, this is something that's a bipartisan issue. The reason the legislature was able to decide to keep tuition increases at zero, after several years of skyrocketing tuition increases, we at least put in $400 million of new money into state universities and colleges in order to keep tuition increases at zero. That was a bipartisan decision. It's my privilege to chair the House Higher Education Committee, and we do that committee's work on a determinedly bipartisan basis, and I've got bipartisan colleagues in the Senate. So I think that's the real secret here, is that all of us in higher education are trying to work together.
So this proposal that you're talking about has been dubbed the Pay It Forward proposal.
Yes.
Do you have bipartisan interest in it?
Oh, absolutely. And I am now, in fact, talking with state Republican senators about these ideas. John Burbank has been very helpful in talking to a lot of people. And across the summer and fall, we'll continue that outreach to as many legislators as possible. And again, this is part of an overall campaign to increase the number of people going to college in Washington State, because we're an undereducated state. We don't have enough people in college to sustain our economy. And we've got to cut the cost of college in order to make that happen.
You mentioned that this is one of a number of possible ideas for cutting the high cost of getting a higher education. And I know that something that was floated at the University of Washington, the institution to which this radio station is licensed, is that idea of a staggered tuition model that, for example, incredibly popular areas like computer sciences or biotech, those would be with sort of a staggered tuition. Those might cost more to make them more available. What do you think about that idea?
Well, you know, the bookkeepers, and it's no secret that UW's folks, there are some people at UW who would like to do that because they say it costs more to train an engineer than an English major. But, Marcy, I'm among those who am opposed to that. It's called differential tuition. For one thing, it makes the choice of a student or a family about which career, which curriculum to study, much more demanding. And we know that young people, I was certainly like this, I didn't know which career I wanted to have. And it tends to pin people down into a specific career track too early. So I think we are better off in these public institutions of making sure that if you're in college, you're paying the same rate no matter what you're studying.
When is the Oregon legislative study results? When are those due out?
Marcy, I'm not sure. My understanding is through the summer and into next year, they would be working on that. They operate on a slightly different calendar than we do. So we'll certainly stay in touch with them. There are other states who are interested in this. And we've got some experts here working in the state. So as I said, I'm hopeful that we will be able, as part of the overall tuition and efficiencies package that we're working on, we'll be ready by January with a proposal.
So you're not waiting to see what Oregon does. You are going ahead independent of that.
Oh, absolutely. John Burbank has been thinking about this for 2 or 3 years. There's been a lot of work done. We've been working on the idea here for more than a year. I wanted to start by making sure that we had the actuarial studies, the lawyering done. You mentioned the federal loan program. We've got to make sure that things like this legally interact with those federal loan programs in a proper way. So there's some kind of technical bill writing work to be done here before we can introduce something that's really practical. And we know it'll work when we do it.
We'll touch back in with you later this year, I guess, and see where you are with it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And again, the problems we're trying to solve here are the debt problem. It costs too much to go to school. The cost of going to college is hurting our economy, and it's damaging the ability of Washington State families to get their kids with the right education.
Representative Larry Sequist represents the 26th Legislative District. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Marcy.
And coming up in January, as you heard, Representative Sequist plans to introduce a bill that would let kids attend college for free up front and pay the tuition after they graduate and get jobs. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Nine 18. Menthol cigarettes, more addictive than regular cigarettes. We'll have more on that in a minute.
Hello, this is Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media. The programs you hear on KUOW are all commercial-free, and that's probably one of the reasons you listen. It's also one of the reasons your financial support is so important to us. Join the thousands who support commercial-free news and information. Make your gift today. Just go online to KUOW.org, and thanks.
Perfect day to become a brand new member of KUOW. It's going to be sunny with temperatures up in the low 80s, currently 69 degrees. Singer-songwriter Shelby Earle in conversation and performance 15 minutes from now.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Menthol cigarettes are an easier habit to pick up and a much harder one to kick. That's according to a new report from the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA says there's no evidence that the chemicals in menthol cigarettes are more toxic than what you'd find in non-menthol smokes, but researchers say menthol smokers have a harder time kicking the habit than do their non-menthol fellow smokers. Right now, the FDA has no specific regulations for menthol cigarettes, but it is moving in that direction. And here to talk more about the FDA study and cigarette addiction in general, Sarah Ross Viles. She manages the chronic disease program at the King County Public Health Department. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If menthol cigarettes are not more toxic than regular cigarettes, why do they seem to pose a greater health risk?
They pose a greater health risk is what the FDA's scientific review finds, because they lead to more initiation, which means more people, and really we're talking about youth, we're talking about kids starting to smoke. And the scientific review also found that they're more difficult to quit. So we have more people starting to smoke and then fewer people who are smoking menthol being able to stop smoking when they wish to.
Why are menthol cigarettes easier to start smoking?
The report also found that there's actually a physiological difference, a different way that your body reacts to menthol. So, you know, to be clear with everyone, the menthol we're talking about here is the same menthol that you would experience in a cough drop, that kind of soothing anesthetic feeling, and that's in the cigarette as well. And for a youth who's trying a cigarette, the initial harshness without menthol can be too much, and they might put it down and walk away, but the cooling feeling that we were seeing from the scientific review from menthol could be a part of what helps youth continue smoking and why we see a much larger preference for menthol around newer smokers and younger smokers that really levels off among most adults.
According to some studies, 4 out of 5 African-American smokers prefer menthol cigarettes, and which I found an interesting figure. Why? Why are these smoking rates for menthol cigarettes higher among African-Americans?
That's a really important question to us locally, because one of the big challenges we have with tobacco prevention in King County is that rates of use among different race or ethnic populations are so different. And a great example of this is our African American rate, which is almost twice what the general smoking population rate is. And if you look at trends over time, you'll see, especially among the white population, the rate going down, but for African American, it really staying level. And so we're beginning to think that menthol might be a piece of this and the difficulty in quitting. Now, as far as why there's a larger amount of use among African Americans, there's a lot of evidence that it's in the study as well for targeting, with marketing being more prevalent in communities that have higher African American populations, and the concepts of ads being more in tune with an African-American community.
You mean that the cigarette marketers themselves are targeting that type of cigarettes at that particular population?
Exactly. And it's not only the content and placement of the marketing, it also can be price promotions, making them cheaper in communities where the African-American population is higher, or sending more coupons and promotions to people who they think will smoke menthol, who they're marketing menthol cigarettes to.
Now, in introducing you, Sarah Ross Files, I mentioned that people may pick up menthol smoking earlier, but that they have a harder time stopping smoking, and I wondered why that was.
And that is a really good question that we're still looking into, and that this report itself doesn't really get into as much, and I think there'll be more research in this area. I'm not an author of the report, and I'm still digesting it a little, so I don't have a great answer there, only to say that they found that the dependence is higher, so the amount of addiction, and that's something that's typically measured in studies by how early do people want to smoke when they wake up in the morning, or do they wake up in the night because they really want a cigarette, and those things are more associated with menthol.
Interesting. In 2009, the FDA banned flavored cigarettes, but it specifically exempted menthol cigarettes from that ban. Do you know why that was?
I'm not part of the FDA, so don't have a specific answer for that. But I think comparing the types of flavors that they banned versus menthol, vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, were lots of flavors that were in cigarettes that were predominantly and almost exclusively used by youth. Menthol cigarettes, on the other hand, make up a quarter of the market share. So I think the decision there might have been to take more study about this bigger piece of the market share.
Does the King County Public Health Department have a specific or official policy when it comes to menthol cigarette smoking as opposed to cigarette smoking in general?
King County is very concentrated on helping prevent initiation starting smoking and also helping people to quit. And we don't have a specific menthol initiative out of that, but we'll be very interested to see what the FDA does. And we're also taking this time to look at our own data to see if there's action that we would do locally. And in the meantime, of course, we really encourage that the number one thing people can do from their health is quit smoking. And now is a great time to call the state's quit line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW, because unfortunately a lot of the quit line services are going away on August 1st. So I really want to push people who are listening who might be thinking of quitting to call the quit line now to get services.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm curious what those services are that the quit line provided.
So the quit line provides both counseling services and then also to eligible callers, which is primarily people who are uninsured or whose insurance doesn't cover what's called nicotine replacement therapy, but people commonly know as the patch or the gum. It covers those services, which really are shown to help people quit. So when you call the quit line, you'll talk to a counselor, and if you call now, you could even have that counselor call you back and do proactive calls to do counseling. After August 1st, the services are greatly reduced so that you could just call and talk to somebody once.
Why are they reduced?
They're reduced because of budget cuts at the state level. The thing that we do have to look forward to is that healthcare reform has required insurance, new insurance plans, to have some kind of cessation coverage that's helped to quit smoking, but that cessation coverage won't necessarily be standardized, and the requirement won't start until early 2014. So if you're thinking of quitting, I would really say to call the quit line now.
So let me just follow up on that. The Affordable Care Act will require insurers to cover tobacco cessation, but there's no standardized plan for what that would look like?
Not at this time. That it was a decision at the federal level to not mandate what the cessation benefit would look like. But we'll certainly be tracking locally and in Washington what insurers are providing to make sure that's an effective quit aid.
Do you have at the county level data that shows what kinds of programs are particularly effective when it comes to quitting smoking?
We have that data is usually from national data sets or even worldwide, things that provide counseling and what's called the nicotine replacement that I spoke to are really effective in helping people quit at an individual level. And then there's also a lot of evidence for kind of the standard pieces of tobacco control. Raising price on tobacco products helps people quit, especially younger people, because they don't want to pay that extra money for something that they might have felt ambivalent about anyway. And also smoke-free places, especially smoke-free workplaces like we have here in Washington, are helpful in people quitting.
Have you noticed that the smoking rate has gone down in King County since we have those laws in place?
Yeah, we have enjoyed a nice decline in smoking rates since about 2000, when the state really started to fund tobacco programs throughout the state and to do state work, including large media campaigns around tobacco. And there's a risk now that that funding has diminished and is almost gone at this point, that we might not continue that decline or that we might even see an increase.
So the county has no specific funding of its own set aside to replace the Washington Quit Line?
In 2013, we do have county funding to do activities, but not to replace the Quit Line. The Quit Line is a fairly expensive thing to run, to look at from a county perspective, and is really a benefit that is more in line with what a health care organization would provide or an insurer.
So you mentioned, Sarah, that at this point you're digesting all the information that came out of this FDA study on menthol cigarettes and looking to see how the FDA might move. As I mentioned in introducing you there, they're considering regulations specifically aimed at I'm assuming, menthol cigarettes and perhaps marketing of menthol cigarettes. How might the county proceed in light of what the federal government does?
And like I said, we are looking at our local data to see if there's any community engagement we want to do around this issue or any local initiatives. Unlike some other states and local jurisdictions, in Washington, there are actually state laws that prevent local communities, cities, counties from taking any policy actions, like you talked about marketing restrictions or looking at the product. That is something that we could not at this time pursue in King County. So that's not part of what we would be considering. But we want to know what our local data look like, especially from the youth issue, and decide our next steps from there and really watch what happens at the federal level.
That's a state law that prevents you from taking action?
That's a state law. That's part of our youth access laws that sit at the state level that were adopted in 1994 and did a bunch of good things, including set a minimum state age for purchasing tobacco, and define where tobacco can be sold from and located. But it does have a piece that prevents local regulatory activity that could affect the sale of tobacco.
Fascinating. As Sarah mentioned, Washington State's tobacco quit line ends next week, August 1st, and you can still call up till that point and get the counseling that you might need. Sarah Ross-Viles manages the Chronic Disease Program for King County Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:30. I'm Bernard Wollett. A conversation with singer-songwriter Shelby Earle in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
The 1980s war on drugs targeted a trendy, ubiquitous white powder. And now?
The production in South America has really fallen. And second, the appetite for cocaine in this country has fallen.
It seems we're winning the battle, but why? I'm Jackie Leiden. The decline of cocaine. That's on the next Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Saturday evening at 5 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, featuring local foods produced in the Northwest with summertime options for picnics and barbecues with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com.
.70 degrees in Seattle. The forecast says it's going to be sunny all day, and we should reach a high of 83 this afternoon. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 58. And tomorrow, Saturday, cloudy in the morning, then sunny again in the afternoon with a high of 75. Coming up a bit later this hour, we'll get a more extensive weekend weather forecast from Washington State climatologist Nick Bond. That's just about 20 minutes away.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle-based singer-songwriter Shelby Earle released her second album, Swift Arrows, this week. Shelby Earle's no stranger to the music industry. She spent 10 years working in it before she quit her corporate job to write and record her own album. It was called Burn the Boats, and it received critical acclaim when it came out in 2011. Now Earle's sophomore album, produced by Damian Jurado, is generating an equally favorable buzz. Shelby Earle joined us in the KUOW studios earlier this year to play and talk all about music. And she started off by playing Burn the Boats, which was the title track from her first album.
I pulled the boats to the shore, tied them up one by one, lit them all afire, sent them to the ocean floor. I set my eyes on a victory, new earth beneath my feet, till smoke and clouds above me was all that I could see. And I prayed delivery. I held my word. This would not overtake me. I would be free, free. I wrote it in a letter. The ships had sailed their last. I sent it to the future, I sent it off to you. Our lungs were full of ashes and our souls were colored oil, but somehow we were dancing, we'd always known the truth. If we pulled the boats ashore and lit them all afire, sent them to the ocean floor, we would be home, home.
Singer-songwriter Shelby Earle, and I'm pretty sure that's the title track from Burn the Boats.
It is.
It is indeed. Now, you need to tell the story of what this song is actually about, because it's
yes.
a beautiful song, but it actually, it means something.
It sure does. Yes, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I quit corporate life to play music. This was about 3 years ago. And it was all very exciting. And I went into the studio right away. And then about 6 months into the process of finishing a record and releasing a record, I went, oh my, what have I done? Just because life gets real and, you know, bills need to be paid, etc. So I had a little bit of a crisis moment and called my mom, who's in California, and she said, well, you know, your stepdad is so proud of you. I don't know if this helps at all, but she said, somebody asked how you were doing, and he looked them in the eye, and he said, she's doing great. She pulled all the boats ashore, and she burned them.
Which means, essentially, you cut off that you were waiting tables, I think.
Well, no, that came
you were,
later,
yeah.
Actually.
No, you had no source.
9 to 5. 9 to 5 life.
You had sort of a musical life before corporate. I understand it, you were a dancer.
I was a hip-hop dancer in Los Angeles for many years, which is a little known fact.
Well, now everybody knows it.
Now everybody knows. But also singing the whole time and playing in bands once I moved to Washington. But didn't get into songwriting until much later.
Why did you decide that you wanted to be on the other side of the music industry? First, you worked at Experience Music Project.
I
worked
did.
At Amazon.
Yes.
So you really were involved in the industry, but why not as a performer?
Well, again, I was sort of playing in bands the whole time, but hobby style. And it just became, well, and I should say, so during that time, I started writing songs. And that was new and very exciting. And it's just sort of snowballed. And I would be sitting in business meetings and thinking of song lyrics. And I finally just went, what am I doing? I mean, my heart and my mind were completely in this other realm. And then, of course, there was encouragement and positive feedback as I was playing shows. And so it felt like it was time to be all in, I guess.
What got you started writing songs?
Well, for many years, my music partner was and is my best friend, Katie Fries, who has a master's in composition. And, you know, so she's a very serious songwriter. And so I just kind of let her take the reins for a long time. And we sort of finished our band out in 2007. And I had to redefine. And I just started playing around. I thought, well, if I just work on stuff in the house, I don't ever have to play it for anyone. You know, that was kind of the original idea. And it went from there, and I started to want to share the things I had written. And I got more and more excited about the process and just started writing more and more.
So that's not scarier to actually take the microphone with something that you've written as opposed to performing in somebody else's work?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been interesting. It's more vulnerable in some ways. And at the same time, I am about 1,000 times more comfortable doing it. It's very strange. I mean, I think it's just because it's what I want to say. It's what I need to say. And Katie is a fantastic writer for other people. So she always did a really great job sort of capturing where I was at. But there's nothing like, you know, using your words, as they say.
Well, it's interesting because you've been in Seattle for quite a while.
Yes.
You've worked in music for a while. And this is a city whose reputation, it's probably changing now, but its reputation is built on a very heavy, muscular kind of rock sound.
Yes.
Hip-hop is emerging, you know, with Macklemore now. But
yes.
But there are, you are one of a number of singer-songwriters who work in I don't want to say a quieter vein, but maybe a more melodic
style.
Mm-hmm. So how do you see what you do fitting into the scene of the city? Are the scenes divided up by genre, or is it a one big pool of musicians?
The scenes, it's interesting. I mean, there's definitely a sort of tradition right now of variety show almost. There's a great event called The Round where different artists will sit together on stage and go song. Sound off at EMP, the band competition. It's hip-hop artists, it's rock bands, it's folk artists. I mean, we're definitely a city, you know, who appreciates all of it, and people are experimenting with combining the scenes. I play with a band a lot, and I sort of move between the quiet solo show and then full rock band sound.
Mm-hmm.
I love being able to have that flexibility, so it means that I can do a lot of different kinds of events. But yeah, I don't know. I think we all appreciate one another, and in terms of the live setting, just kind of learning to share the stage and share the audience, I guess.
Because you had both the professional and the musical connections in this town, I wonder how that influenced the first record that you put out. Was it easier because so many people knew who you were?
Well, you know, I definitely had a lot of support that surprised me and thrilled me, of course. I mean, I self-released Burn the Boats early in 2011. I re-released it later in the year on Local 638 Records. But even when I self-released, I mean, Amazon, for instance, did a Song of the Day promotion. KXP did a Song of the Day promotion, Zune.
You know, NPR.
NPR, yes. How could I forget?
How could you forget that?
And even the NPR one, even though it was a national feature, it was Barbara Mitchell, who's a local writer, did that pitch. And so, yeah, the support has been astounding. And that's definitely because I knew people on the business side, but then they liked the music. It wasn't just a friend deal.
You self-released, but you funded that through Kickstarter, I believe.
I did. I had a little seed money when I left the big job, and that got me started. And then I did a Kickstarter campaign about halfway through, right about the time that I went, oh my gosh, how am I going to finish this?
Were you originally funding it with savings from Amazon? I mean, was that it?
Oh, Marcy.
Well, maybe you don't have to answer that question. That's my job to ask those questions.
But short answer, yes, partially, yes.
Well, you're not the only artist now, because the nuts and bolts, the dollars and cents of the music industry are so different from when you were at EMP, for example.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, everything's different. And it seems that most artists, maybe a label picks them up, but often the impetus, getting them to commit that music to a good quality recording as opposed to, you know, using Rock Band in your bedroom.
Right. Yeah.
It does require $15,000-$16,000 sometimes.
It does,
and
yeah.
It's almost all self-raised.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why, you know, platforms like Kickstarter are just fantastic. And especially as people move to more and more sort of internet radio format and listening, you know, to the Pandoras of the world. I know people think that artists get paid, but we, you know, we see cents, literally. So then for the crowd to fund in a different way, it makes a lot of sense and is hugely helpful.
Now that first album, Burn the Boats, came out a couple of years ago, and your Swift Arrows, the second album, is coming out. How is it going to be different? You've been working on it for a while with Damian Jurado,
yes,
a well-known local musician. How have your sounds evolved since that first recording?
You know, quite a bit. This has been just such an amazing sort of pivotal process working with Damian, because when I first met with him, he said, here's what I want. I want you and a microphone, and we're going to build the whole record around that. And so we did. We tracked it live. We tracked my guitar, and I had two other guitar players with me live, actually. It was a really interesting, all Damian's idea. And then we did about half the songs that way and half the songs full band in one room live. So including vocals. So, I mean, most people say, no way, you don't make records that way now. But Damian is all about feel, and this is how he makes records. And I just, I mean, his last record, Maricopa, I said, whatever you did, that's what I want. And so he definitely lets the heart lead. And we, you know, John Roderick produced Burn the Boats,
right,
and that was also an amazing process, and I'm so proud of the record. But it was just a very different process. We built it, you know, over mm-hmm. time. And this one happened, we tracked the entire thing in 7.5 days. And I mean, so it's very much a moment in time. And the sound, I think what's different about it is it feels more raw. It sounds more live, and I think that will surprise some people. And yeah, so it's going to be different.
Well, it won't sound a whole lot different from you sitting with a guitar in a talk studio. We're talking with Shelby Earle, and I already said it, so I'll say it again. Swift Arrows, her second album's coming out. How much time do you spend on the road right now?
You know, it hasn't been this last year. I've really been here writing the new record and then recording. So this year, that focus will definitely change to getting out and about more. Austin, the first of that, and then a living room show tour starting in late April.
What is a living room show tour?
Well, this is
what it sounds like.
Yes. And this is another part of the sort of changing industry model, is that artists just want to connect with fans, and driving to a town and playing in someone's living room for their friends is the best way to do it. So,
oh my God.
There are a lot of artists doing it. Dave Bazan is one of the local artists who has really sort of made this model successful. So I'm taking his cues on this.
How do you set those up?
Well, I'm working with a great company called Undertow Music, and they manage Dave Bazan and Rocky Vodolato, who's also local. And so they have done this a bunch of times. They're going to teach me the ropes.
Wow. Well, so Shelby Earle coming to a living room near you. Is that how we do it?
Not first living room, then maybe your local rock venue. Yeah.
And do you still have your day job?
I do not have my day job. In fact, I have also left the restaurant job now. So now we're all in.
Wow. So you've already burned the boats. What else is there to burn?
Oh, wow. No, I think it's done. Now we're on the front lines, Marcy.
Well, it's wonderful having you here because, you know, this is early in the morning, folks. This is live.
Yeah.
And we're getting that beautiful live sound. Swift Arrows, Shelby Earle's second album, produced by Damian Jurado, her first album, highly acclaimed by everybody, including former colleague now of NPR, Ann Powers, is called Burn the Boats. It's been delightful meeting you and having you in the studio.
As well, thank you.
And we're going to have you play us out. What are you going to play?
This is Swift Arrows, in fact.
So there you go, title track on KUOW Seattle.
When words are not enough, when words are all you've got, you'll find one poison-tipped swift arrow in your mind. To have one is all you want, so you'll find more poison tipped swift arrows in the air, and they'll find your poison tipped swift. Are everywhere, and they
And now, the sound of the day. Sounds a little bit like a drain that's clogged. It is actually the sound of liquid nitrogen escaping from its tank. Hiss, hiss, hiss. That sound was recorded by our listener, Hans. He's the director of audio at ChefSteps.com, which is an experimental kitchen located in the heart of Pike Place Market. Hans says that's the sound he hears off and on all day because his workstation is located right next to that tank of liquid nitrogen. I'm not quite sure what they use that for. Whipping stuff, maybe. Bernard says, yes, if you go to Weekday's Facebook page, you can see some very cool videos of this type of cooking, what they do at Chef Steps. They make liquid nitrogen berry drops and aerated green apple sorbet. I think that's that modernist cuisine that we hear so much about. It sounds awesome. What are you listening to and where are you listening to it? You would be very welcome, invited, in fact, to record 30 seconds of what you hear every day and send the sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. Now, it is Friday, and perhaps you are lucky enough to be near a window, and the sound that you hear is people laughing because the weather has been, multiple choice, A, beautiful and summery, B, oppressively hot, C, boring. Washington State climatologist Nick Bond, what is your choice, A, B, or C?
Well, I'm afraid I have to come in with C there.
You think it's been boring, Nick?
Yeah, but, you know, I understand. It actually has been beautiful, and recent days have been a little bit on the warm side for many of us, but still, it's nothing like some of the other parts of the country that are just oppressively hot and humid.
Well, do we want to talk about the end of boredom? You're about to get happy?
Well, no, not so much. Today will be another beautiful day with a little cooler, with temperatures probably in the low to mid 80s. For the weekend, we do see more clouds. And cooler high temperatures. And Sunday looks especially like solid clouds in the morning. Hard to say how much is going to clear in the afternoon, but definitely cooler on Sunday. And then into next week, the kind of standard issue, summer weather pattern of morning clouds and the afternoon sun, temperatures maybe near or slightly below normal, mid to upper 70s. So not any real excitement. We're getting into the climatologically driest time of the year, but it actually, next week, we can't completely rule out the chance of showers. I think it's only like 10 or 20%, and maybe a little higher in the mountains. So the bottom line is, not much going on.
No, Nick, we haven't seen any measurable precipitation in quite some time, have we?
That's right. The last measurable rain at SeaTac was in the last week of June. There were some thunder showers in the area earlier in the month, but they just happened to miss the airport. And we have had previous Julys without measurable rain, but there's only one on record, and there's others with just very scant amounts. August of last year had no measurable rain, so it's unusual but not unprecedented.
Has it been warmer than normal? We talked about warmer at night last week, but it seems that these 80s are not really typical for us.
Yeah, that's right. Our high temperatures normally are in the high 70s in western Washington this time of year, and at least the last few days been running 5 to 10 degrees above that. Again, it looks like it's going to cool off some, but we've compared to some previous summers, we're running warmer than we have been, and we can see the effects all around us.
Some of them are good.
Yeah, I picked a ripe tomato last night, and I've been growing the same variety in my garden for over 25 years, and there's been only one other instance that I've picked a tomato in July.
Wow. And the same type of tomato.
Yeah, same type, early girl, for what it's worth. And moreover, it seems like the blackberries are really coming out like gangbusters. And seems on the early side to me.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, last year I was picking blackberries at the end of September. But do people keep records of blackberry ripenings?
Right. I looked around and couldn't find anything. And, you know, if I was a better man like Thomas Jefferson or something, I'd be keeping a diary of this sort of thing. But unfortunately, I didn't find any sort of information. Most of the kind of postings on it indicate that the harvest season is August and September. And so, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a bit on the early side.
So these are great things if you have some time to hang out in the sunshine or the semi-sunshine and pick fruit and pick tomatoes. But there are some downsides to this very warm weather besides not being able to sleep at night.
Yeah, and in poking around to try to find some information on the timing of blackberry harvest and that sort of thing, I found that there's a kind of a new and unwelcome visitor, the spotted wing Drosophila type of fruit fly that is moving up from California to Oregon and actually targets cane fruits like blueberries and blackberries and raspberries.
No!
Yeah, and at least the commercial growers have some real concerns, and there was all this stuff about, you know, how to control them and that. And they apparently favor higher humidity. And along with a kind of a trend toward warmer nighttime temperatures here, and there's plenty of year-to-year variability, and there's real concerns about how much urbanization is affecting our measurements and so forth. But our humidity levels are going up also. And they're still delightfully low compared to places like Alabama and that sort of thing. And they vary from year to year. But still, there's that upward trend. And perhaps this fruit fly that's coming in is in part response to that sort of thing.
But for now, I'm just going to say today's weather is going to be A, beautiful and summery, and C, boring for you. And then tomorrow we're going to see semi-boring, low clouds in the morning, marine air in the morning, and then clearing off by the afternoon?
Yeah, that's right. And the whole trick here and just how warm it will get is how stubborn the clouds are. And then it looks like they're going to be more stubborn on Sunday than on Saturday, and so probably cooler temperatures, just maybe into the low 70s. And then next week, again, kind of morning clouds, afternoon sun. But there's some hope by the weekend that, again, we'll be coming back into the 80s. And so the beat goes on.
Thanks so much for sharing your boring forecast. But I hope you enjoy your tomatoes.
Oh, well, thank you.
Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. And he is with us every Friday with a weekend weather forecast. Coming up in the next hour of the program, our journalist roundtable will be talking about mayor's race. We'll be talking about new proposed pot regulations. We'll be talking about Whole Foods, and we'll be talking, yes, I'm sorry, about the new Little Prince. That's coming up after 10 o'clock on weekdays. Stay with us.
A moderate earthquake hit this morning off Vancouver Island. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Edward Snowden is still camped out in the Moscow airport without home or country. Let us compare him to other famous fugitives like Leon Trotsky.
He was killed by an ice pick.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.